Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the host and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have problems with these thoughts, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios, Atlanta!
This is Registry Matters, episode 308, is that right?
That's
308.
Right.
Well, here we are at the conference in Atlanta, and we have 1,000 people in the room. Do you think that's accurate?
I think you might be undercounting.
Undercounting, wow. We have enough space that people are able to spread out. They don't have to do the alternating breathing like we did last year.
Well, it looks pretty tight.
Okay, all right. Let's just dive right in. First of all, press like, subscribe, YouTube, Patreon. You guys know the drill. Thank you all for coming. I really, really massively appreciate it. It shows a love of sport and really touches my heart, Larry.
That's hard to do.
Yes, it did. Do you have any, what are we going to do tonight?
I think it's totally open.
I want to tell you a story. That I was driving into town, and I had driven straight through. I had been on the road for, 11 hours, and I drove straight, didn't even stop for lunch. I stopped for gas once, and so I left at 6:30, and now it's, I think, 5, and about halfway through, I was like, oh, shit, rush hour, Atlanta. Rush hour in Atlanta runs from about 3 in the afternoon till maybe 8. It runs kind of forever. It almost like never even ends even. And so I end up coming down like 85 and it merges in with 75. And then I hit the parking lot known as whatever where IKEA is. What's that?
Atlantic Station.
Okay, near that area. And I'm just like, okay, whatever. So I had the windows open and somebody drove by me and they're like, I was like, oh, you want to get in my lane? I was like, okay, I'll let you in. And she's like, whatever. And she drives off. And then I look, all my gauges are up saying my car's overheating. And I was like, uh-oh. I'm like 5 miles from the hotel. I've driven 700 miles. And I'm 5 miles from the hotel. I'm like, fuck. I pulled over and I stopped. And I was like, well, I don't see any smoke anywhere. I opened the hood. I was like, let's try. Go back in, turn it on, and I knew I was just going to blast the heater. The gauges come back down. That was great. I was like, fuck, I'm going to be stuck. Is that funny?
That is definitely funny if you ask me.
Not funny, Larry!
I don't know what to think. Does anybody in here at least one agree with me that that's funny? You think it's funny? What?
I think it's funny.
Wait, way in the back. Can you stand up? I'm sorry, can you stand up now? We still can't see you. Please come up here.
So I've got one person out of this massive audience. Is there at least one more that thinks it's funny?
I think it's funny.
Oh, okay, you.
So, okay, now.
What's your first name, if you don't mind?
Desi.
And you want to interrogate this woman, don't you?
Well, I just want to say bless you.
So, oh, that's bad.
You have a great sense of humor. That is a funny story.
So it's only funny because it happened to me, isn't it? Out of all these years, I've tried to get you to admit something's funny.
I think it's the other way around.
Possibly.
But it is funny. So two people, is there at least one more maybe?
It's kind of funny.
Man, God, you guys are rough. It's not cool.
So there's some hope for the audience. It's funny. So I might not get fired for saying things are funny.
Thank you very much. Larry, I have a question for you. I've noticed a police officer walking around the hotel. And we are essentially, if there were a congregation of PFRs in one location, the hovercrafts, all of the hovercrafts across the country would be here, wouldn't they?
Well, there's... Well, there were several hundred registered, and a couple hundred showed up. And we hired the police to provide security. And I haven't seen a single officer asking anybody for ID or how long they've been here or interrogating anyone. Nor did you see the hovercraft anywhere, any of the hovercraft.
I haven't been outside. I've been working, so I don't know.
Anybody seen the hovercraft?
I seen a drone.
there is a drone. So, but point being that law enforcement doesn't go around looking for people who are at events to arrest them. They just don't, but there are a lot of people holding anxiety about that. I've been approached no less than half a dozen times at this event, people saying, do you guys not understand that we could be in trouble? There's a swimming pool in this hotel. There's a church or whatever. I've heard different things that why people are not allowed to be here. And I said, do you really think they're watching you like that? How would they know that you're a PFR? Is it written on your forehead?
We had a conversation with someone very recently. He lives roughly in the area, Larry. And he, like, easy enough to drive into town, but not enough that he could, like, walk across the street. And he said, I'm not going to stay at the hotel because it has a pool. And he's not on supervision anymore. He's still, quote unquote, just on the registry. And I was like, I don't understand. I don't personally understand. And if it were me and the situation was reversed and I was still, I don't even know if I was still on supervision, I don't think I still would care. Because I stayed here. You were like my introduction to Narsal at this hotel in 2015 or so. Actually, it was the one kind of around the corner from here. But I stayed in this hotel in 2015, a year after I'd been out of prison. And I asked probation. They said, sure, no problem. I don't understand the fear aspect of that. Can you explain?
I wish I could. I know people have anxiety. I have my own anxiety issues that are related to things, but I can at least pinpoint some basis for the anxiety. This, we cannot find a single case nationwide of anybody who's ever been charged for overstaying whatever the prescribed limit is. Nowhere, nationwide. So in the National Defense Lawyers group that I'm a member of, on the State Defense Lawyers group, with all the Narsal affiliates, with all the tentacles we have out there, not one. But it causes the most anxiety of anything. If we were to be in a state for 73 hours, that's 73, 2 hours, they're certain that they're going to be arrested. So I say, well, okay, is it theoretically possible? Yes, theoretically possible, but why don't we look at the evidence? We have no evidence of it ever happening. And then we have counter evidence of it not happening. We had a massive police presence in Albuquerque when we had a conference there, not because we paid for them like we did here, but we had a massive police presence because the vigilantes were trying to run us out of town. The Albuquerque police had no interest in us other than keeping us apart from any trouble. And then last year in Houston, we had the Proud Boys, and we had a fairly significant police presence. They had no interest in whether anybody had been there more than 5 days. They knew what we were doing.
I think there were like a dozen cops.
There was at least that, if not more. Here.
Was it really?
Yeah, there was more.
Really?
Yeah.
I missed all that. Okay. So there were two dozen.
Here we've had a police presence that we requested and paid the cost for. No one's ever seen anyone go through a hotel lobby asking for identification. How long have you been here? When did you arrive? None of this has ever happened. But yet it's a continuous source of anxiety. And I call it an imaginary boogeyman because it's not based in anything other than fear. So I don't know where it comes from.
You used an analogy of the parking lot where I'm going to assume that the vast audience of 8,000 people, that however they park, that if there were cars kind of stacked on top of each other, that the vast majority of you people would be kind of okay, like, oh, well, this is what I got to do. But Larry was telling me earlier,
it causes me massive anxiety because I can't see as well as most of you can. I see through one eye, and I have one eye that is not attached to anything visually, so I lose the perception of depth. So if I get in a challenging situation where cars are stacked where they shouldn't be and they're too close, I can't tell where they are. So I have to get out of the car and go walking back and to try to see where the car is in relation to where my rear end is that I'm trying to back up, or what, even the front end of the car. So when I go into a parking lot like this that's stacked with cars that shouldn't be, I'd be having, if I ran this place, there'd be car wreckers towing people out here nonstop, because I want you in a parking spot and I don't want people, because I know what I face in that situation. I can't get in, I can't get out. And I'm in a panic attack when I come out and you're like 3 feet away from me and I'm trying to figure out how to maneuver past you. So since I know it bothers me, I'm not going to let anybody else be bothered by that. But no one else would think anything about it. They would just wiggle their way out and say, well, you know, it's just a part of life. So I have that anxiety because I can't see.
Does anybody in here have some kind of anxiety of something maybe related, unrelated, that you just want to share briefly? Brian, I'm sure you do. You afraid of flying?
No.
Even in a plane that you're finishing tightening the bolts?
Maybe a little bit.
It was deemed airworthy, Brian.
Yeah, sure.
Larry, would you have anxiety getting into an airplane with someone that just finished tightening the last bolt an hour before you arrived?
If I knew it, I might. But
I'm sorry, what's that?
I'm anxious about meeting new people, especially like personally, because I don't know if they're going to want to try to make false accusations against me if things go wrong.
You got to watch out to who you're sitting next to, though. But Big Mike said he has anxiety about meeting new people because they may not, probably wouldn't make a false accusation. But like on a risk-reward scale, the chances are really low, but the consequences are kind of through the roof.
But see, your anxiety has some basis. People have had false accusations made against them. My anxiety is real because I can see the cars when I'm going through the parking lot, and I can see that I will be in real trouble trying to exit. So that anxiety is real to me. But the anxiety that people are having, they can't cite anything that supports it. Not a single prosecution anywhere. Massive police presence at conferences year after year. They've never seen anybody roaming through a hotel lobby. Management would never tolerate that. If you started going here, if the cops showed up and said, well, we thought there's a group of sex offenders here. We want to find out how long they would never tolerate that. Commerce would come to an end if police came in here and started badgering the guests. So it's never happened. No one can cite to it. And then I say, well, just out of curiosity, well, how often do you get pulled over? Because I say, well, what if they were to, if I were to encounter the cops and get pulled over? I say, well, okay, you, for example, when's the last time you got pulled over?
Me?
No, the guy here with the blue. When's the last time you got pulled over?
Don't remember.
It's been many, many years. So,
hey, Larry, let me ask you this question. I'm going to put you on the spot. We have 200-ish registered at the conference?
Yes.
Okay. Would you venture a guess at what the economic impact, I realize like it doesn't even register on the economy of Atlanta, but are we a drop in the bucket to the hotel? Do we matter to the county?
We matter to this property. And this property matters to the local economy because they're a revenue generator. They generate lodgers taxes, and they're good for the local economy. They're just not going to come in here and start hassling people unless the management invites them in. Now, just why would the management invite them in after they booked an agreement with us, and if they breached the agreement, if management said, by the way, we got this group of sex offenders coming down and we want you to come hassle. I mean, why would they do that? we wouldn't come back again if they did that. So all of this is without any rational basis. And so if there's somebody can rationalize it, I'd help me understand it, but there's nothing supporting the fear. It's just a fear that we've got all these advocates that tell you that you better call a lawyer before you travel, I mean, really, you don't need to call a lawyer to travel, but I hear that kind of advice. Call a lawyer before you go out of the country. I would never think of calling a lawyer to travel. So it's like...
Well, before we move on, Larry, I want to tell you that I met someone today that I'm going to invite on the podcast soon, and I don't want to like spill the beans and all that, but he has a lot of background and research on like psychology and stuff like that, and we had a pretty in-depth conversation about kind of like this subject about fear and fight and flight and all that stuff. So in the near future, I hope to have this person on so we can dig into this from like a medical statistics. You might not actually join us on that show because statistics and whatnot, math.
I don't understand statistics. What? So statistically, though, the odds, and I told one person, I said, well, your car could blow up into 1,000 pieces, but how often does that happen? It could theoretically happen. It's an internal combustion engine. What would stop it from exploding one day and killing you? I mean, couldn't it happen? But so it's like, but you don't stop driving. You don't stop doing other things. But people will not come to a conference because they might be an hour over what they think the limit is. And sometimes there's really no limit because it's so unclear. It's an administrative interpretation because the law itself didn't define a category of temporarily present. So they say, well, if you have to register within 3 days of moving to a state, it stands to reason that you would have to register within 3 days of visit. No, that does not stand to reason. That's your perception. But a prosecutor has to cite in the statute verbatim when you file a criminal complaint. You have to cite for the accused to know how to defend themselves. You have to cite the section of law and what's precisely they are in violation of. And you say, well, they were in Georgia three long. Okay, I'm the defense attorney. Okay, where does it say that? Where does it say that they can only be in Georgia 3 days as a visitor? If it doesn't say that, wishing it doesn't make it so. But they say, well, I'm sure that there would be something in the law. Well, if it's not in the law, wishing it's there doesn't put it there. And it's like, well, I don't know what to say. It's like, I don't know how else to help people understand. The fear is misguided. Could it happen? Yes. If somebody was following a minor around his hotel and the parent or guardian happened to pick up that NARSL is a sex offender advocacy, and the adult saw that person's, they saw their child being followed by one of us that had one of these lanyards on, is it possible they could call the local police and they would come out? Yes, it is very possible. And if they were to describe the person wearing the blue shirt that I just called on, he would probably get a knock at his door and he would probably get an interrogation. But nobody else is going to be bothered. So it's like, but all this stuff is possible. Now, I'm an older white guy. So
how much older?
Very old. Very old. 183 as of Wednesday. But so not being a person of color who tends to have more encounters with the police because of profiling and prejudices, I can't say that if this audience was all people of color that the same thing would apply, because I don't know. I haven't lived that life. But so I can't speak to that. But I can tell you, as most of this audience goes, the police are never going to encounter you or bother you. You're not who they're looking for. You're just not. I live on the border, and we have border checkpoints in New Mexico, 25 to 30 miles inland. And when you're driving 25, 30 miles inland, everybody has to exit. And when you're an older white guy, all they're waiting for you to say is U.S. citizen. And they're waving your arms, waiting for you to say U.S. citizen. And they keep the traffic moving. So I've never encountered anything other than long enough to say U.S. citizen and being waved through. Now, I don't know if I was 26 and I was tattooed head to toe and I was other than a white person. I don't know how that, because I can't relate to it because I've never had to roll up and encounter that. Perhaps maybe they get more detention, but they're not bothering you. You know, they're not looking for you. So that's just the reality.
Can we move on?
Sure.
All right. I have two or three like sort of planned subjects, but what I'm most interested in, first of all, you have to be willing to come and kind of talk kind of close to that microphone. But if you have any questions that you would like to ask, you have some time to collect your thoughts. And in about 10 minutes, we can have an open Q&A. And as long as the questions are good, we can run this train all night, Larry. But
who determines if they're good, me or you?
I thought they found the black bag.
What? Okay. So how many people have one of the blue balls?
Oh, gentlemen.
Do you know what the origin of it was?
I
So when we started, I mean, you know, we're like episode 3. We probably started Patreon like around 20. And I was like, I know. I have to give people an incentive or, you know, some sort of reward. And someone suggested to me, it's like, oh, you know what you should do? People have to go to treatment and it's kind of stressful. So give them a stress ball, but make it blue balls. So that was the nexus of this. And then it is a pain in the ass to address an envelope and stuff this thing in there because it's not, it just doesn't really work and it's expensive. Anyway, so I was like, then I came to a conference and I essentially gave them all away. But these guys have just kind of been hanging out in my house or in my car or whatever. And I will give them away. And I also have some fridge magnets. Okay, so we'll figure out a way. So I guess if you have a really good question, you get blue balls. And if you get a mediocre question, I have enough, so shh. But Larry, I have a question that I asked someone to compose. And this should be crafted fairly well, Larry, because he actually was an attorney at one point. So here it is. There are some of us who received deferred adjudications. You mentioned that one of the movements in state legislation with regards to softening the requirements of the registry was that for those of us who had received no conviction, such as deferred adjudication, should not be subject to registry requirements after their supervision. How do you end up on supervision if you didn't be found guilty of anything to begin with?
That sounds like more than one question to me.
Actually, there would be one because I would have to ask you to explain deferred adjudication. But may I finish or should we take this in little chunks?
Keep going and I'll decide what I want to answer.
All right. So for instance, I completed 10 years of supervision, but I still have 10 years registry requirements post-discharge because of Texas. Would such a softening help me? Or do you have good news for those of us who've had the benefit of such diversion adjacent programs?
I don't like most of those.
diversion adjacent programs? Would you at least start with, like, what is deferred adjudication?
It's really conviction withheld, an official entry of judgment against you. But that doesn't change everything that you think it does. Most states use that deferred adjudication or adjudication withheld. In New Mexico, we don't use that terminology. We call it a conditional discharge, but same type of sentence. So you get in trouble. You're generally a first-time offender. You got no prior criminal history. They're trying to spare you of having an official conviction, and so adjudication is going to be withheld. But unfortunately, the issue of registration was never addressed when they drafted the registration statute in those states. Things get overlooked. So like in many states, they came back later and said, the group of people registered includes those having received a deferred adjudication. And in my state, we've never done that. We've got statutory language that says that conditional discharge is specifically excluded from registration. But there's some states where they've come back and made it clear that those type of dispositions must register. And in, I think, and maybe even Florida, but there is a state that comes to mind where the court said, well, if the legislature had wanted it to be exempt, they would have said so. They didn't say that, so therefore, you have to register. Well, I can see how they could come to that decision because as a conservative, you would not want legislating from the bench, would you? If the lawmakers wanted that in there, that particular exception, they would have put it in there, right? And you don't want nobody wearing a robe to do something the lawmakers didn't intend, would you? If you're a conservative. I'm not saying everybody here is conservative, but the conservative point of view is that I don't want no legislating from the bench. I want them to follow that law. And so some courts have said, well, if they had wanted it, they were smart enough to say it. They didn't say it. So deferred adjudication would be you admit the elements of the crime, you admit that you could be convicted, and you're usually placed on a period of supervision, even though you're not convicted. And then if you complete that successfully, the adjudication is withheld. It's never entered. That judgment's never entered against you. So that's how that outcome results. But still, you could end up having to register with no conviction.
That's I still can't figure that out. Oops. Not guilty, registered.
They're not saying not guilty.
I know, but to me, Larry, the opposite of not being convicted would be not. To me, that's how I hear it.
But then you didn't hear what I said. I said that
I wasn't paying attention.
That you admit the elements of the crime. So if I'm your defense attorney, I would go in and say, look, this is a first-time offender. I want a conditional discharge. Counselor, you can argue for a conditional discharge. I won't strenuously oppose. That's what the DA might say. But in order for me to get that outcome, I have to agree, the client has to agree to the elements that they committed that crime. So all the elements, you sign away your life saying, I did these things. I admit if I screw up this deferred period that I am the person that was accused. I did these things. So then they've got your conviction on a platter. So if you screw up, that conviction will be entered against you. And if you don't screw up, then the conviction is never entered. But nonetheless, factually, you admitted that you committed the sex offense to get the deferred adjudication.
Is this at all like an Alfred plea?
Not exactly. The Alfred plea, you're saying that the state has the evidence and they are entering the conviction against you when you do an Alfred plea. You're saying it's in my interest to plead guilty. But in this, they're never entering the conviction against you if you complete the period of successfully. You don't have a conviction, but you have a duty to comply with the civil regulatory scheme of registration.
And then, so I think when this question came up, the ACLU lady had put something up regarding people with deferred adjudications, and that was something that they would be interested in supporting, I guess, would be the way to word that. And this kind of fits into that framework, that mindset that the ACLU would have about the civil rights of people with deferred adjudications, them being on the registry?
You have a track to play for that?
It got recorded. I had 10,000 other things going on at the same time for me to like actually repeat that.
So the if you're asking me, do I think that there's any credible litigation because of that?
Fair, yeah, okay.
I don't think so.
How about legislation though? Could you get legislators on board to follow along with that?
Let me do what I seldom do. Let me answer a question with a question. Do you think you could get the victims' advocates to stand down?
Certainly. Definitely. I'm sorry. Can we change this to just be no? Everyone say no.
So here's what you'd have to do. You'd have to get all the people in the victims' arena, their corner, the prosecution, and the advocacy organizations to stand down. Because if you were to propose legislation to exempt those who have been factually admitted that they committed a sex crime, I just don't see that's going to be an easy vote for a lawmaker to do, to say, well, you know, the victims' advocates say that we should, the victims' advocates would say, we're going to lose track of these people and they could harm us. And we have the right to know where they are. So you'd have to be willing to go up against that and say, despite the fact that the law enforcement apparatus and the victims' advocates apparatus, we're going to vote to remove them from registration. I think that's a tough sell. But
I had someone run out to go track down the individual that wrote the question. And so I believe Stefan here is going to ask it.
No, and there's good news for those that are out there on deferred adjudication. The state of South Dakota doesn't count discharge from deferred, or doesn't count deferred adjudication as a conviction. So my read of South Dakota statutes,
you wouldn't have to register.
You wouldn't have to register. It's a wonderful state.
All 12 people that live there. Okay. They're Sturges, right?
Yeah.
Isn't that what's there?
Go Sturges.
Oh, right on.
Okay, well, let's just see. Who thinks South Dakota is a wonderful state?
Oh, we have one. There was one. Why would South Dakota be attractive?
Christine
knows. What?
Casinos.
What is
casinos?
Oh, casinos? They have casinos everywhere. That's what I thought. That's what I thought you said, but you heard.
Lots of reservation casinos in South Dakota.
The Badlands.
The
The Badlands. Okay.
It's great.
Mount Rushmore.
It's south of North Dakota.
Would you call that a good state to go to?
I've never been there, but all that cold air blasting through,
no kidding,
continuous winds and no people.
I might like to
know people at times though.
No speed limits either.
All right, I have another question for you.
I have to correct Larry about the cold weather.
Yeah.
I drove across South Dakota in September and it was 105 degrees.
Yes, it's hot during the summer there.
Well, there's nothing to contain it, so it's just got to get massively cold, but then also probably pretty warm. Okay, now Larry, I have to keep names anonymous to protect people. I heard one of the panelists say something that I was like going to jump up and down and go, but. And so I'm going to paraphrase this as best as I can. But the individual said that John Roberts is the one that was the state representative, whatever, to do Smith versus Doe. Is that roughly correct?
That's not the way
it was.
State attorney, thank you. I'm sorry, thank you. Is that better?
Yes, I was thinking he was the Solicitor General, but
okay.
Yes, he did argue the case before the
Supreme
Court.
So he argued the case, yes. And now he has been promoted up, whatever, and he's the HMFIC of the Supreme Court.
What does that stand for?
Head mom frack in charge. So he's the head man on campus corralling the other eight justices.
So far, so good.
Okay.
Yes.
And then the statement, this is where everything went off the rails. This individual said that he is aware, he needs to be made aware that he made a mistake in Smith versus Doe, and it is now his job to correct that mistake. And I was like, how is he supposed to do that? I realize, Larry, that they don't give a crap about stare decisis anymore, so they would potentially go back and reverse their decision if they felt to. But they can't just go, let's look back in the filing cabinet from 2000. Oh, here's a good one. Let's bring this back up. That's not how that would work.
That's not how that works. No.
At all.
No.
Somebody at a state level would have to bring forth a case that would go up through appeals and whatever in the circuit. And then they would have to grant cert. Is that roughly right?
Roughly right, yes.
So how would a person with letters after their name and legal experience, am I misinterpreting the way, you weren't there to hear it, but how would somebody say that that's how the process would work?
Well, you know, he shouldn't have done this because, see, everybody, is there any notes in front of me?
No.
Okay, so this is all extemporaneous. I have no idea what I'm being asked. I don't think he made a mistake. So you've opened up for me to pontificate.
Yes.
I don't see the mistake that he made. So what mistake did he make?
Somebody has to have standing to bring that.
No, not you, Roberts. What she said, he needs to correct his mistake. What mistake did he make?
Please, somebody tell me, what mistake did he make? Anybody? Nothing? I'm sorry? That's what we are referring to, yes. So what mistake did he make as being the Solicitor General in 2001 representing that case?
He was on the wrong side.
Say again, Jason?
That the recidivism rate was probably a
half. But was it his job to introduce that like as new evidence, as fact?
So, but see, this is where I and the legal community differ completely. And he opened this up, so we might be here what it took midnight after all.
You've got 3 minutes.
Can't do it.
All right, moving along. Just kidding. Go.
So. I don't think that as his job existed as Solicitor General, I think that's what he was. His job was to argue on behalf of Alaska before the Supreme Court. You would want the person to do their job, right? So he was doing his job. And it was not the state of Alaska that moved for summary judgment. It was the complaining party that moved for summary judgment. And that that constrains the lower courts in terms of what they can do, because facts are established by trials and weight of evidence, credibility of witnesses. If there's no credibility of witnesses, facts are established by stipulations made by the parties. They agree that certain facts exist. Alaska was never going to stipulate and agree that the registration as it existed then in 2003, not the way it exists today in other states that are so horrendous, but they were never going to say that the registry is punitive because you had to fill out a form and you had to mail it in. They were never going to agree that that was punitive.
That seems very disabling and restraining.
They were not going to make that stipulation. So the only way that the Supreme Court could have declared it unconstitutional would be to find that it imposed punishment, because regulatory schemes are not punitive. So therefore, your best shot would have been to have a trial. But if you move for summary judgment, the non-moving party gets all the benefit of their untested defenses. Every inference is made and resolved in favor of the non-moving party. So if the person who doesn't want to be registered said, you know, this is a no-brainer to the trial judge, we don't need to have a trial, all you got to do is look at this as an ex post facto, this didn't exist when I was convicted, declare this an ex post facto violation, we're done here. Well, they forgot that there was a case in 1963, decades before, that determined how there was precedent in Kennedy versus Mendoza-Martinez of how to figure out if a regulatory scheme imposes punishment, and therefore they couldn't be imposed retroactively. And when they looked at Kennedy, Mendoza, Martinez, the Supreme Court said, well, looking at these seven factors, and primarily I focus on disabilities and restraints, they said, we don't see any disabilities or restraints. You're not told where you can live, where you can work, where you can travel to. You can do what you want to. All these things are not in Alaska's requirements. You have to mail in a form. This is not much different than renewing a driver's license. So therefore, Alaska says that the reason why they're doing this is because recidivism is high. They couldn't reopen that because that was assumed true because there was no trial. And since there was no trial and there was no development of the record, they had to resolve any doubt and ambiguity in favor of the non-moving party. So therefore, I don't think they made a mistake. I think the mistake was made by the attorneys representing the challenger. And I think we're mad at the wrong people. I think the outcome would have still been the same had there been a trial, because there was nothing to the registry at that time. They didn't say you can never register anybody in the future. They said that this scheme is constitutional. You can register people as this requirement exists. They didn't say that anything you can dream up and add to it. They didn't say that you can do that. They can't address that because that wasn't before them. So at the time, I think the decision was correct. So I don't know what he would go back and apologize for and what he would do and how he would correct a mistake, because he didn't make one, in my opinion. So...
But could he?
He would not be, but the point you were getting at is that they don't go through a file one morning when they're bored looking for something to decide. So there would have to be a petition for cert. They would have to be at least four justices agree that there's something meritorious there. There have been ample cert petitions presented to them about registration. Michigan wanted the Supreme Court to review the adverse decision they had from the Sixth Circuit. They said, no, we don't choose to go revisit that issue. Pennsylvania wanted them to grant cert. I forget which county it was, but a prosecution office in Pennsylvania said they petitioned for cert, and they said, no, we don't want to look at this again. Four justices were not in favor. If you can't get to four, you're not going to get to five, because it takes five to have a majority. So if you can't get to four to grant review, you're never going to get to five to overturn Smith versus Doe. And the court now is even more conservative and more pro-law enforcement now than it has been in a long, long time. So even if you got a case before the Supreme Court, I'm not convinced that you're going to get a different outcome. But who knows? Maybe I could be surprised. But I think it's dangerous getting a case before this Supreme Court. I think that we could be saddled with a more advanced current-day version of registration being declared constitutional, and we could be stuck with this for decades to come. I think we are basically going to have to keep fighting in the states and taking cases to on state challenges and looking for state constitutional provisions that maybe they were more favorable, because some state constitutions have stricter prohibitions against ex post facto than the U.S. Constitution. So Maryland, for example, and Pennsylvania, for example. So the Pennsylvania Supreme Court was smart. They said, you guys, you don't get to decide this because we're deciding that this is unconstitutional based on our Constitution. And our Constitution provides a higher level of protection than the U.S. Constitution. So there's nothing you can do here. And that was very smart because they made it on their state constitutional provisions.
To interject, we have alcohol in the back, Larry, and there's a blue bottle and a red bottle. The blue bottle is winning. Now red's ahead?
Red's always been ahead.
Red has less in it, so if that's winning, it's
okay.
I think
someone's going back there to try and tie it.
Trying to help blue catch up.
Perfect.
Now, this reminds me of college dorms, of those red cups that people still drink out of those when college parties.
It does look like Listerine.
An ounce and a half, like 5 ounce glass of wine and 12 ounce beer. The lines have a purpose.
Well, I was always wondering what's so popular about those cups. You see them everywhere, coast to coast. If you're at a college, they're drinking out of red.
They have their own measuring system inside of
it. I never knew.
There's a great song about it.
I never knew that.
Anna Kendrick.
All right. Does anybody have a question that they would like to present to probably Larry? But me too, if you want to. But probably later. So if you do, please come up, lie about your name, tell us your first name, and ask away. Anybody? 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 All right, we're done. Good night. Come up.
There's 170 people still here.
170,000?
You were 170 million.
Good. You can probably stand up, or you could take a chair there if you'd like. But
I'll just take a knee.
Very good. All right, then.
Okay. Hi. My name's Amanda. Just on the topic of the ex post facto clauses. I just had a question. So if somebody was convicted and they took a plea where their offense originally was not required to register, but in the future they would have to register eventually, if it's in the plea, would that still be considered ex post facto, or because they took a plea deal with it, even though at the time of the offense, it wasn't a registrable offense, I guess, is my question. Would it still be considered ex post facto at that point?
Hold on, Larry. In your non-professional legal advice.
So the offense was not registrable at the time of the plea, but the registry existed, and later they added the offense after the person had pled.
Correct, but the registry was included in the plea.
That they would or would not?
They would have to, yes. They would have to register at the time of their plea.
Okay, was the registration obligation for the duration of the plea or for permanency?
Permanent.
Is that offense still not registrable, or is it registrable now?
It is registrable now. It was a couple of years after the offense happened.
Then he's stuck.
I actually tend to lean towards his answer. But there are caveats to that. It would depend on the state. If you were in Maryland, where the ex post facto clause says no disadvantages, you might have some traction. But clearly we have notice of the registry. It both existed and it's mentioned in the plea. He will never be able to convince any judicial officer that he would not have pled but for the absence of a registration obligation. If he agreed in the plea agreement that he was aware of the registry and he has a registration obligation, even though one didn't exist by law, I guess the question would be if either there was a prohibition against disadvantages or if he could somehow convince someone that he was coerced into doing the plea and that he would. I mean, it's an extreme long shot. What state are we talking about, out of curiosity?
Michigan.
Yeah, I think it's a real long shot. What did the legal professionals say that you've talked to through the years, the last seven lawyers you've talked to about this? What
they just say they can't help us. You know, they can't help with it. And when we start talking about it, we haven't gotten very far.
Well,
I know there's some new legislation going on. That's kind of why I brought up the question, because there's like a subclass, and there's another DOES lawsuit going on. We're waiting. got an answer.
Well, when they added the offense, see, I'm very, very big when the state of New Mexico wants to add an offense. I want to say for conduct occurring after a certain day. The language of how they added that offense would be very critical to the analysis, because if it was silent, if it just said this offense is now registrable, then you might not have anything to hold your hat, to hang your hat on. But if, depending on the language of the applicability, so you're looking at you're looking for the bill, the year and the session that made it a registrable offense, and what does it say in terms of who it applies to? So if you were paying me big bucks, what I would be looking for is I would be trying to figure out some angle of it was added for prospective convictions or prospective conduct. And I would argue that the statute supersedes the plea agreement. That is the counter argument to what I would normally make. I would normally say the plea agreement takes control of the statute. Well, it supersedes that. But since this would benefit my client, I would do a big flip-flop. And I would say, well, the statute is obviously, that's what the people of Michigan intended. And they said for conduct occurring after this date, my client's conduct occurred on this date. So therefore, he's not covered. And I would be as comfortable in keeping a straight face and making that argument, because it's what would serve my client's interest. And normally I would say, if the plea agreement actually addressed registration, sometimes the plea agreement will actually specify, usually just says you have a duty to register. This offense will put you within a zone of registration. But if the plea agreement says it's a 10-year offense and the plea agreement was wrong, I'll say, well, wait a minute. This person made a contract with the state, and the officer of the state should know the law, and they represented this as a 10-year. My client would have never agreed to this if it was going to be a lifetime, and I think that the court ought to compel enforcement of this agreement, this binding agreement. So you see the flip-flop? Mm-hmm. But I would be honest about the flip-flop. This is the argument I would make. If you have any hope, the language of how they made that crime registrable is your only hope that I can see on the brief facts. It's like, hey, he shouldn't have to register, because this is for conduct that occurred before. And then the state's going to come back and say, well, he agreed to register. Well, but he was misled by his incomplete and lack of thoroughness by his attorney. And the law supersedes wrong legal advice. I mean, that's the best I can come up with.
Yes, I appreciate your insight.
So, did anybody come up with anything that good of the lawyers you talked to?
No. No, you're the best yet, Larry, so thank you. And I just want to point out, I have hope. That's why I'm here. So, thank you very much. I appreciate you taking my question and answering it.
Sure.
All right. Thank you, ma'am. Who's next? Who's the next victim to come up and ask a question? Anybody? Seriously? Nothing?
Blue ball.
Well, I know. I got. Come on. We got one away. I got a. Nobody? Nobody?
We got one.
We got one coming up. Slowly making the way all the way from way, way this, back in the arena. All the way back.
This one's almost as old as I am.
Turn a hair to your right. It is on, and go for it.
Yes, I have a question for Larry. For this year's conference, did you buy a new shower head? Or have you used it? Are you using the same one from last year?
I did not bring my shower head this year.
You got blue balls.
But what I did...
That was an excellent question.
What I did bring that's always in my travel luggage is my channel locks, and I needed them.
Channel locks.
Yes, I need them, because that's what I would take the shower head off with. But I've been here to this property before, and the water pressure is pretty good, so I didn't bring it. But when I got here, the drain in the sink wasn't draining. And the reason why it wasn't draining is because it has an unadjustable pop-up, and it's too far down. So I tried to back it off by screwing it counterclockwise, and I didn't have enough strength to do it. And I wouldn't call maintenance, because I know exactly what they would tell me. They would say, well, no one has ever told us that before. You know, this is the first complaint we ever had. So I just went ahead and gently gripped it, got the thing started, and I spun it out enough, and then it's draining just fine. And so I do my maintenance when I'm traveling as well.
Out of curiosity, how long of a shower does it take before it fills up the tub?
Oh, no, it's the sink that where that was.
Oh, the sink. I'm sorry. Yeah. I thought you were talking about the sink. Oh, is it really? Yeah. I haven't used anything.
All you need to do is back that, turn it counterclockwise and back that off. But see, it's they've got them really tight because they don't want you to turn them. So I have, I'm prepared for making the necessary adjustments when I'm traveling.
Well, thank you for that question.
I have one more.
Do you have another one?
Yes.
Okay. Is this the real question?
Yes, yes, yeah. So I was wondering, earlier in the conference, I brought up about the Americans with Disabilities Act, some of the registry requirements, sometimes it doesn't comply with the ADA. So what happens when you have two statutes not going well with each other? How does one try to challenge that or make some inroads with that to bring up the issues of how it's hard to follow some of the requirements without with the ADA, because some of it is challenging and difficult and.
Larry, here's the scenario. You have a person that is visually impaired, and they are required to fill out a form for their registration. And if they don't fill out the form, they are in violation, but they don't have the faculties to fill out the form. Who wins?
Great question.
That's why he has a blue ball.
We don't know. But it would...
I'm out now. I'm out now.
It would be a fertile ground for litigation, because it's not only people who are visually impaired, it's people who are on the spectrum of autism, people who, basically not fully mentally cognizant to understand what they're required to do and to comply. And it's not because they don't want to comply, it's because they can't comply. And it would be great litigation, in my opinion, for someone to put forward. But what they're going to do is they're going to say, whether it's true or not, they being law enforcement, they're going to say, if the person had asked for help, that's all they would have had to have done. And we would have filled out the forms for them. That's what they're going to say, Charles. So you're going to have to document. And and it's kind of hard to tell a visually impaired person you do a lot of documenting, but you're going to have to document proof that you've tried to get assistance and you're notified. It's like people when they'll say, I call my PO. Now, we're living in the digital age, and I'll say, well, you called your PO. First of all, you wouldn't make a phone call if your life depended on it, but yet all these people tell me they called their PO. And I say, well, your PO is not going to ever admit that you made that call and left that message. So how are you going to prove it, since the burden is on you to prove that you took these steps? How are you going to prove it? They said, what do you want me to do? And I said, well, you're going to have to up the ante in terms of having confirmation of the communication, which means something digitized. Now, when I was on supervision the last time, it was not where we are today, but we did have fax machines. So I was in the habit of sending faxes. And of course, has anybody sent a fax in the last 10 years or received a fax in the last 10 years? In the last 10 years?
Many people raise their hands, Larry.
When purchasing property, sometimes faxes come.
Yeah, so, but that, I mean, that's a very antiquated. We don't, I work in a law practice. We do not have a fax machine. We have e-fax. And we get an e-fax maybe every 9 months. If we get one a year, we're lucky. So it's like, but I was doing faxes. So if I wanted to travel outside of the county, you had to have a permit, or you had to have at least verbal permission. I would notify the PO that I've got to go to Sandoval County to do some filing of court papers. And this is to let you know, because the rule was for me, since my job required travel, is notify us before you take the trip. Well, I wasn't going to call and leave a message because I was vulnerable. How could I prove I made the call? But the facts, I had the confirmation, so I'd have a picture of the facts, and I'd have the confirmation sheet. I'd staple them together and put them in an old-fashioned file cabinet. And they got sick of getting those facts, I'm sure, because they knew that I had documented for future. But
that's a lot of work.
In order to do this successfully, someone's going to have to file a challenge, and the burden's going to be on you because they're going to say, we would have helped, but we never knew they had a problem. That's what they're going to say. It may not be the truth, but that's what they're going to say.
I received a comment about this. It says, I do a lot of stupid things. I'm not speaking about me. I'm speaking about from the person's point of view. I do a lot of stupid things and have been in the hospital quite often. My registry office told me to call them, and they would send an officer to help me with anything registration related that I couldn't do. So I'm just picturing like the guy with like toilet paper wrapped around their whole body and their arms are up, like raised up in the air and like a leg, and like, I can't fill out the registry paperwork. And they would send somebody in. I have a hard time believing that they would do that.
I don't know if I agree, because I know in my county they do send people for elderly folks. They do send. I find it very humiliating and unnecessary. And I tried to stop it with legislation saying that they're supposed to send out a form and the person's supposed to return the form rather than having to go in and start the whole process all over again. But they're hell-bent on taking people's fingerprints again. So they go out. They'll make a hospital visit or a hospice visit or a VA to the VA medical center. And they take their old-fashioned fingerprint ink cards out, and here this old guy's 100 years old, and they're reaching over in the bed and saying, we got to push your fingers on. So it's like, yes, they do it, but there's no need in all that, but they do it. So I'm not saying I disagree with you. I mean, I actually say I am disagree with you. I think they would make, in some instances, the house call, but they're not necessary. They know where the hell you are. You're in the hospital. You're at the VA or wherever, but they still go out and humiliate you and go through that BS.
Any other questions? Uh-oh, here comes one. All the way from the back. All the way. State your name, serial number, and rank. And
1, 2, 3, 4.
Okay, that'll work.
Hi, I'm Kathleen.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, Andy. Larry, I have a question for you. So this kind of piggybacks off of what the other young lady said about a plea deal that was not, well, in her case, it was whether or not it was viable at the time or whatever. My question is, what if the government reneges on the deal? What happens then? What are the avenues someone could go through to try to rectify that?
Well, what your first step is, if there's a bona fide plea agreement, you move to enforce the plea agreement. And it's generally interpreted under contract law because it is a contract.
So do you have to get a new attorney to do that? Or is there a form? Or is there a avenue that's...
Well, you wouldn't have to get a new attorney. The attorney that did, if they're still around, could do...
Oh, they're a horrible attorney, obviously, because the plea deal sucked. So, but...
I was going to say, but you might want to get a new attorney.
Okay.
I wouldn't advise trying to do this yourself. They're going to laugh you out if you try to enforce a plea agreement. The system's just not set up to deal with pro se litigation. So if you go in saying they didn't follow the plea agreement, the judge is going to turn his chair around facing the other way and ignore you.
Okay.
So, but if you say when they violate it, just... Then a synopsis, quick synopsis. How did they violate it? What is the renege that you perceive?
Well, in a nutshell, part of the plea agreement was to drop charges against someone else. And they did not, in fact. They persecuted them. So, they didn't honor the deal. And he's still doing his 17 years that he took to free this other person.
So, the plea agreement was they would drop charges they didn't drop.
Correct.
It seems like to me that person's attorney would be on board with this.
That person's attorney is a dick.
If I had that kind of, if I had compelling evidence and someone said, I'm supposed to not have charges against me because it's part of this person's plea, I don't want to do any work. That seems like the first approach I would use to try to get my client sprung.
Okay. Isn't that how Bill Cosby got off?
Is it?
I think so.
There was another piece that
there
didn't
was
happen.
There agreement that he had agreed to, and they violated.
It was a civil agreement. He had civilly agreed to admit things in exchange for they wouldn't prosecute him. And yes, that is in essence.
Okay, so get a lawyer.
Get a lawyer.
It's the problem. Okay.
I didn't hear what that person said.
Say that again, please,
louder.
Pro se is where the problem is.
Okay. Thank you.
So,
Do I get something? A magnet? Something?
I will totally give you.
Jesus. I stood up here and talked.
You can get into it first. Just saying.
She doesn't get blue balls?
No. No blue balls for you.
Not once.
Not once.
Guys get blue balls.
That's very true. If there are no questions, we're going to shut it down. Now, so, anybody?
We drove 3,000 miles in an overheated car.
Right?
Did you ride with him?
No, but he drove. Oh, God. He drove.
But wait, I had to drive with the heat on in Atlanta in June. It was going like 2 miles an hour on the interstate.
Just think how much weight you lost sweating out that.
Yes. I came in on. Anything from anybody?
There's gotta be.
There's gotta be something.
Gotta be something else.
Anybody? Okay. Returning, I'm not giving you a magnet.
That's fine. I just had a question, kind of going off of what the gentleman earlier had asked about with the ADA compliance and the registry requirements that go along with that. So, in the future, I haven't heard anything about this, but do you think there'll be any type of like legislation or move forward to create some kind of universal requirement that the officers and state police and the registry, the people who run the registries in all these different states would have to abide to provide the same type of registry requirement universally in the U.S.
Do you mean that to say that all states would have 1,000-foot living restrictions?
No. Like the registry requirements, like you have to go in person.
Okay.
To register, or like some states you can call in, some states you can email. But
do you really want that?
The
reason why I'm asking, because the people in Vermont are probably really happy with their, hold on, they're not really happy with their situation. However, if they were to compare it to Mississippi, they're really happy. And if we met in the middle, Mississippi would be great, Vermont would be crap.
Well, I guess I'm trying to say some type of reasonable registry requirement.
Oh, well, that's not.
But what is reasonable out of this anyway?
I guess what does Vermont have that makes it different from Mississippi, if you can elaborate that?
For just one example, correct me if I'm wrong, Larry, which I know you will, level ones aren't on the website.
Okay.
They also don't list your address, 123 Main Street. They list you live in this rough town.
Okay. No, not the same requirements, just the accessibility. So, like, I guess.
Suppose there are hundreds of things that you have to comply with, and they're different in each state. Mississippi, if I'm not mistaken, is 3,500 foot for the worst people that they can live from schools, daycares, and that one doesn't include churches. But Georgia has 1,000 foot. Everybody has 1,000 foot from schools, playgrounds, parks, daycares, libraries, and churches.
Yeah, I think I might have misworded my question.
Wrong. Okay.
Not just like the requirements, but like if you're like signing your name, like just to go in person, make sure your address is correct, make
yep.
sure your name is correct. Not, I guess that
I'm,
part of
I'm
it
with
if
you.
You're moving.
I'm with you, but like, so Florida just started allowing people to register online.
Yay.
Georgia, you can't.
So
you have to go in, but you don't have to give them email addresses either.
Okay.
But it's only certain things in Florida that you can
get
online.
Yeah.
Right?
With Michigan, they don't have that 1,000-foot rule anymore. They also don't have to report internet identifiers for a certain, like, number of offenders, depending on when your
Certainly.
Crime happened. But, I guess.
I'm not trying to berate you. I'm trying to help.
Yeah. No.
Find
no. No.
Point.
Yeah. Like I said, just making like it accessible with like for ADA, like to be compliant with ADA, like not having to like somebody like.
That's fine. You can say it.
The accessibility
okay.
is like what I'm really looking for an answer on.
Well, okay. I think I can zero in on her question. She wants to know if the things like the gentleman in the back are dealing with, since there is a federal requirement, I think you're trying to say, shouldn't the federal government require the states to do X related to the registry at a very minimum, right?
That's what you're trying to say. That is what I'm trying to say. So, yes, correct.
So,
okay.
So and I think that's an admirable goal, and I think that it possibly could happen because disability advocates do exist in greater funding, greater numbers than what we do. So if we could somehow get that advocacy involved, that those who advocate for people with visual disabilities, those with mental disabilities, there's a lot of advocates for people with disabilities. But the question is, would they go near sex offenders and jeopardize their funding because it might be adverse to their interests? That's the reason why the ACLU doesn't do any more litigation than they do in this arena, because they look at their donor base and they look at their funding sources, which are donor bases and winnings from legal cases. They see these cases often as very difficult to win and a losing proposition. So then they're looking at spending a lot of money for a case that's not winnable and alienating donors. That's not a winning combination for a business model. Mm-hmm. So I think that if in a pure world where everything was the way it should be, these disability advocacy organizations would be appalled by what's going on with people with mental challenges, visual challenges, dementia, all these things that make it difficult. But will they come out and advocate for that? I don't know.
I think it's going to take some time. Like, it's going to take somebody to have something happen, and they're going to want to take a stand, take it to a lawyer, you know.
So, but if they were to advocate in unison, I think Congress would be very receptive to saying, hey, we've got to accommodate the disabled. Mm-hmm. But this particular segment of the disabled population is not going to be much more popular than a regular offender, because somehow or another they would say, well, they abandoned any protection by what they did.
Really?
That's what I expect. I think you went out and took this gentleman that has a visual impairment, and nobody knew that he had an ancient conviction from overseas from decades ago, and they saw him, they'd want to help him. If you took him out, the same individual, and said, and by the way, 40 years ago, he was convicted of whatever, I never look up people's stuff, but if you said he was convicted of something 40 years ago, they would say, well, he ought to have thought about that before he did it.
Yeah, I understand your point.
Yeah, so that's how mean we are. Yeah, you hear like jail conditions. I would never think of depriving a person of food and of decent quality environment, because we've taken away their ability to defend themselves. We de-weaponize them. We strip them of everything. We force them into a cage, and then we tell them, well, we're not going to take care of your health care needs. We're going to feed you about half the calories you need. Mm-hmm. And yeah, we're not going to let you have any contact with the outside world except for with something blaring in the background. It's costing you a fortune to hear that this call is monitored and being recorded. And people say, when you say, well, this is not right how we're treating people, we're gouging their families for ungodly amounts of money for phone calls and commissary. They say, well, they should have thought about that before they did it. They should have thought about that before they did it.
Yeah, I agree with that. Not that, but...
You don't agree with it, but that's the reality of what it is.
Yeah, I understand, but like a lot... Things can happen to anyone at any time, given like the right situation. Like, they're not right, but, you know, specific situation, you know, wrong... You know, person, wrong place, wrong time. You know, and, you know, some... Some people, yeah, right.
Nobody else.
Right. So, I thank you. And thank you very much, Andy, as well. Appreciate it. Thank you
Absolutely.
For giving me the insight.
I just have one final question that has been asked, and that would be, well, okay, go ahead. Come on up.
Sorry. Hey, Larry.
This is scary. I've already been on a ride with this guy today.
You got in his car?
I did.
Wow.
Got a quick question for you. I heard you just mention that some people on the registry, they can't go to libraries and everything. When can we expect our tax refund because we're paying taxes on services that we can't use?
I wish people would litigate that And I don't know what the outcome would be, but if you're forbidden to do all these things, it's very peculiar. You still have to pay for them.
Right, thank you.
I love that argument.
Do you have any highlights from the conference, Larry? Oh, I'm sorry. Were you going to come up?
No, don't.
I'll ask that now. No. Wow.
I just had a question because it might have been covered.
You just turned it off.
There you go. So I just have a question, and it might have been covered. But the Whitehead ruling in Florida basically rolled back that you can't put that level of 25 years on someone that was convicted before 2004 because of the 20-year to 25-year statute. It was considered ex post facto. In your opinion, Larry, even though it was in a circuit court that doesn't have any type of jurisprudence in the 11th Circuit, can there be any type of persuasion with that ruling, if you're familiar with the case?
I'm not familiar with the case.
I didn't think we'd cover it when you asked me.
I didn't think you did, but...
So what? Where's the decision from?
It's from Broward County.
But I mean, what level of court?
Circuit.
Well, 11th Circuit is precedential.
No, sorry. Sorry, it'd be the district court. It's... what's Broward's district court? It was in district court, appealed to the 11th Circuit. The 11th Circuit PCA'd it, basically, because they gave him a way off the registry, but not made it basically for everybody.
Did it apply to him?
Yes, because when you have PCA, there is no appeal.
What is PCA?
Per curiam affirmed.
Can you say that again?
Per curiam affirmed, which is Latin for it is done. It's finished.
Okay.
So... I was just going to ask about the Whitehead case because it was brought up earlier today. If, even though it doesn't have precedent in the 11th Circuit, can a ruling be used for persuasive reasons?
Absolutely. We use non-published opinions all the time.
You can use one from a completely opposite side of the country, right?
Yes, you can use it, but... If I were more familiar with that, I could be more intelligent. But I would argue it if it's a well-reasoned opinion from a district judge and it was per curiam affirmed, I would say in this fantastic, brilliant analysis in the district court for the Southern District of Florida, affirmed by the 11th Circuit, this analysis says this, and I would use that in litigation. Absolutely, I would. So,
very good question.
But I wanted blue balls.
I know. Sorry.
Said the first man ever.
And by the way, that is the tallest, handsomest guy in the room tonight that did that.
Thanks, Larry. Tallest. God, we gotta be like that.
Somebody asked in chat, what did you guys DoorDash without me? I have no idea, but I just figured I'd throw that out there. Anything else? Yes, ma'am.
Andy.
Can you please come up?
Yes.
And you didn't think I'm funny, so I am not going to answer your question.
Thank you. I did say you were funny, Larry.
You said I'm funny?
Okay. I did.
Yes, she was one of the dissenters, or not dissenters.
I was a not dissenter.
So I'm funny.
Yes.
All right.
You're hilarious. So this is my question. Andy,
yes,
will
ma'am?
You please tell us what FYP means?
Oh.
Oh.
We need another blue ball.
Nope, that's all for
the
next
one. Yeah. Do you want the dirty version? Or you want the
yes! Dirty? Yes!
Dirty!
Dirty! Dirty! Dirty!
Can I?
I guess you can bleep it for the... for the distribution.
You already got two F's in there.
You said the F word twice. Yeah, you already dropped the F bomb.
Battery's low on the laptop. I'm not kidding. All right, so let's imagine that you are living in your house, right? and you are hanging out there. You've got your boxers on, and you like don't have your makeup on, right? And you hear, and you're like, what? So you go up to the door, and you like, who, what? And you like, open the door. Someone on the other side says, I demand to know who lives in this house. You're like, what? I demand. It is my right, because you live somewhere near me, that you tell me who lives in this house. I need to know their names. I need to know your driver's license number. I need to know your hair color. License number on your car. I need to know where you work.
Tattoos.
Possibly tattoos. Obviously eye color. They say they demand to know this. What? Now you have to use FYP. That is the requirement.
Okay.
What would be your response to someone that comes to the door and makes those demands? You ready? Here we go. 1, 2, 3.
Fuck you people.
Thank
you. Many things to say.
Anything else, real quick, before we go?
How about the contents of the blue ball?
Whoa!
Oh. You were asking him the highlights of the show.
I did. That was the highlight of the show.
Of the weekend.
Yes. Do you have any highlights, real quick, from the? I literally am at 5%. And it's
a
big laptop.
I don't have any highlights. It's been a very good, I'd say almost great conference, except for the typical snafus with food issues that some of you experienced.
Hey, man, real quick. We have AC in here. You can't bag over, like, it shit happens. But this is the highest attended one?
I think so. It's really the highest attended. And this property was built in 1972, so give them a little bit of psych, but they're definitely deferring maintenance on it. There's a lot of things that are just obviously in need of being taken care of that haven't been. So elevators don't work. The carpet is gross when you come into the entryway. I mean, the HV system is iffy.
It adds character to have the gross carpet.
Yeah.
It tells you a story.
But hey, they brought everybody together, right?
Scars are beautiful.
There are random odors as you get down by the cafeteria.
What?
Okay, that's probably the end of this. I thank everyone so very much for coming over. I thank you so very much, and I hope everyone has a great night. Travel safely when you leave. And why are you here? I'm sorry? Oh, you're going to be first? Okay, look, there's about 25 people in here, and I have, I think I now have 12.
11.
So, all right.
1, 2, 3, FYP.
Well, how about this? How about the end of the show says, probably nobody makes it that far? No, you've never listened to the end, have you?
No, this is my first podcast.
308 episodes, and someone's still a newbie in here, Larry.
This is my first of everything this year.
Whoa.
This. Right.
Okay. All right. Does anybody know what it says at the end of the show? Like at the
There's
very.
Two versions in here.
Okay. Right. Great. Does anybody know? Anybody? Seriously? So Larry's good friend in New Mexico is a guy named Rick MF, and I'm not going to say his last name, and he's got an amazing voice. And at the end, it says, you've been listening to FYP.
Whose voice is that, Andy?
I just told you who it is. I just told you. Have a great night, everybody. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to FYP.